Hello, and welcome to WDRT 91.9 FM. My name is Tony, and I'm your host today for a special interview. I live in Reedstown, Wisconsin, with my wife, Elise, and our two kids. We also farm there. We grow grapes, apples, and some pears, and we make cider and wine out of it all. Our farm is called Las Mujeres Farm and Winery, and it's no exaggeration to say that our operation would not be what it is without our guest today, Botan Anderson. Botan lives and farms in Zephyr Valley Community Cooperative, located just a little ways west of La Crosse. He started farming by hand in the late 90s, and his experience learning how to do that led him to found One Scythe Revolution. One Scythe Revolution is an importer and distributor of hand tools for farming. It is an invaluable and dynamic resource for many farms, farmers, gardeners, and hobbyists. In addition to farming and supplying us with tools and farm education, Botan is also an artist, scytheman, teacher, and he'll have to confirm this because I don't know this for a fact, but I think he may also be a musician. Welcome, Botan.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Thanks for making the drive down.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I wanted to start by asking you to fill out the context of your work a little bit. When and where did you originally start farming, and what did that all look like? What were you growing? How were you growing it? And who were you growing it with?
Well, I've been interested in farming pretty much as long as I remember. And when I was a kid, I lived in a small village in Germany, and the farms were on main streets, the Bauernhofs. And the farmers went out to fields from there, and a lot of them still had horse-drawn plows and wagons. I always asked my school friends, you know, can I help harvest the potatoes? But they never wanted me. But anyway, so I knew I was interested as a kid. And then my parents moved to the U.S., and they got some land, and we started having horses. So I started learning how to, we started making our own hay, and I thought I'd be really excited to do, but turns out balers and tractors, and they're just, you know, loud and messy, and haying was dusty, and I had hay fever, and bales were heavy, and it was just really hot work, and which I did with enthusiasm for a number of years. But then, I went to college and was studying art, and then attended a Francis Moore LaPay Diet for a Small Planet conference. Mm-hmm. A lot of my artist friends were vegetarians. Mm-hmm. And she showed a film there called The One Straw Revolution, mm-hmm. which featured Masanobu Fukuoka, a Japanese farmer, mm-hmm. who basically farmed with just a sickle and a hoe. Mm-hmm. And he had this rice field that had like the highest yields of any rice field, mm-hmm. just because he would return the straw and some manure to the field, never actually tilling it, though he did use flooding to suppress weeds and so on. Mm-hmm. But it was just building the soil without ever tilling it. Mm-hmm. And then he managed his hillside orchards by setting back the unwanted vegetation with these long Japanese sickles, mm-hmm. these long-handled sickles. Mm-hmm. And he would overseed the vegetables he wanted, or whatever crops he wanted to grow among his orange trees or in the orchards. And, mm-hmm. and in the film, he said that if a farmer learns to farm with nature, he'll have the rare commodity of leisure time. Mm-hmm. And I heard that, I says, that's what I want to do. And in my leisure time, I'll make art.
Yeah, he wrote poems, I think.
Yeah, he did. He wrote poems and did little Zen paintings. Yeah. Kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, from then on, I was living in the city. I just gardened and little garden plots in this, city and suburbs. And ironically, the first thing I got into was biodynamic triple digging.
Triple digging.
It was a lot of tilling.
Wow, that's
just a ridiculous amount of tilling.
Did you do it by hand?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I had a broad fork and a triple digging broad fork and spade.
Wow.
And
why not?
And yeah, I made compost and did really intensive garden beds.
Uh-huh.
And triple digging in clay. It was an amazing amount of work.
Wow.
And the compost that you mixed in just disappeared, and you just had even harder clay.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think it was working too well.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a community education event at a community center in Minneapolis, they were showing a film called Bruce Stout, The No-Work Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And that featured Ruth Stout, who had a small garden next to a big hay field.
Mm-hmm.
And she hired a farmer to bale the hay.
Mm-hmm.
Baled the hay for her, and he got most of the crop, and she got a big pile of straw bales to use as mulch in her garden.
Mm-hmm.
And she developed what she called a no-work garden, which is you just mulch out the soil with thick amounts of hay.
Mm-hmm.
And you just part the mulch if you want to plant seeds or put a starter plant in, and you bring the mulch back around the plants as they come up.
Right.
And so the hay is always decomposing, the worms, coming up to feed.
Mm-hmm.
Retains the moisture of the soil. She hardly ever had water except, maybe the seeds and the starter plants.
Right.
Suppresses
weeds.
Yeah, that sounds way better than triple digging.
It is.
I started buying, I couldn't find hay in the city, but I started using straw, and I'd make my own compost. I would still dig a little bit, but only the first layer with a broad fork.
Yeah.
Mixing the compost and cover everything up with mulch. And then I started being at a point where I could think about moving to the country and buying land.
Yeah.
And then we spent 2 years looking, and I finally found 20 acres that I liked a lot, and we started building a house. And at the time, I was watching a gardening show on cable with Elliot Coleman and Barbara Damrosch. It was called Gardening Naturally.
Uh-huh.
And I was trying to think of a way to be able to cut my own hay and not have the horrible machinery that I had experiences with in high school and college with my parents' horse farm.
Right.
So I don't like machines. I don't like the noise.
Mm-hmm.
I want to deal with fixing them. And
I couldn't
afford new stuff.
Yeah.
So you have to buy old stuff, which you have to refix all the time.
Right. You have to become a mechanic.
I have no interest in working with machines or getting grease on my hands. I like to be outside in the peace and quiet using, my broad forks and so on. And I was trying to think of a way to make my own hay, and then one day the Elliot Coleman's gardening show had a little section called Focus on Tools.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he featured the scythe.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, in this country, there are two kinds of scythes, and he called them the English scythe and the German scythe. Mm-hmm. And he preferred the German scythe.
Mm-hmm.
And then he showed how to use it, and he turned around and he started mowing down this patch of buckwheat, just lickety split.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, that's it. That's how I'll cut the mulch for my Ruth Stout no-work garden.
Right.
And so when we moved to our house, and the first two tools I bought was a broad fork and a scythe from Johnny's Tools. And I had ordered on the phone and asked the woman at Johnny's if I'm 6'5", would that scythe fit me?
Uh-huh.
And she says, oh yeah, it's adjustable. And then she asked me if I wanted the sharpening kit, and I says, no, I'll just wait till it gets dull.
Uh-huh.
And
just wait till it gets dull. You don't need one to start.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Uh-huh.
Well,
that's a dream, I guess.
Yeah, so anyway, I got the scythe, and I could cut like knee high. It was like a scythe basically for 5 foot to 5'8" at the most.
Uh-huh.
I'm 6'5". So.
Uh-huh.
And the blade wasn't sharpened at all.
Yeah.
So I didn't know you had to sharpen it completely sharpen it, had no edge
whatsoever. Knife, like kitchen knife sharp, basically.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say even that sharp. It's like the only way I could cut anything was just to whack like crazy.
Whack it, yeah.
Yeah, and then, so that wasn't getting anywhere. So then I called up a company called Size Supply, and I talked to Elliot Fishbein, the founder of Size Supply.
Mm.
And I told him what I had. I was 6'5". And
what year is this, do you reckon?
Like 2001.
2001, okay.
Yeah.
There's a Size Supply. Does that still exist?
Oh, yeah. They're the number one size seller in the U.S.
I'm horrible at using the internet.
Ah.
I found you. So that's
good.
A wonder. Yeah.
Cool. Anyway, I told him I was 6'5", and he was just laughing at the other end. He says, like, that scythe will fit 5'6" at the most.
Uh-huh.
And he asked if I had sharpened it, and I said, no. And he says, those things don't come sharpened at all.
Oh, no.
So I asked, can you make a scythe for me that would fit 6'5" and
uh-huh.
and sharpen it for me?
Uh-huh.
And he said he would. So it arrived in the mail like a couple weeks later, and it was a phenomenal difference.
Yeah.
And I could just...
It fit. It was sharp.
Yeah.
It came with sharpening equipment.
That too.
Yep.
And anyway, I just put the blade up against the foundation of my house and mm-hmm. just started walking along with the blade sliding.
And it just...
Along the wall. And it just like
cut
the grass that
was
going up along. It's like wow. This is going to work.
Sharp. Yeah. Cool.
So then I started to trying to cut my own hay to mulch out these garden beds.
Yeah.
And by that time, a lot of grass had gotten to seed, so I'd like meander out into the field just cutting things that weren't in seed. And then I'd dry it in the hay, and then I'd haul it back. I had a garden cart by that point. Elliot had advised I get one.
Mm-hmm.
And well, the hay just kind of like bounced out of the cart. You
know, right.
Tie it down. You couldn't haul a lot.
Right.
So I figured out it's just a lot easier to roll the hay onto a tarp and drag
yep.
it. So I could drag quite a bit down there.
Yeah.
And then I had the garden beds all laid out, and they're push rail mower width apart
because
mm-hmm. I was going to mow the pathways with a push rail mower.
Uh-huh.
But the hay field I was putting the... my garden in had a lot of orchard grass and was just clumpy,
mm-hmm.
hard clay with clumpy grass.
Yeah.
And the push wheel mower just bounced everywhere.
Yeah.
Wouldn't cut much. And so I thought, well, you know, I've got plenty of land and I got a scythe.
Yeah.
Why not put the garden beds a scythe stroke apart?
Yep.
So I rearranged the whole garden and they were a scythe stroke apart. And I had them, like, they were like 4x8
mm-hmm.
beds.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kind of reminded me of a cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that's not going to work. So I made the lanes
longer.
I made the beds longer.
Yeah.
With exactly one scythe stroke apart. So the mulch I cut right there gets used right there,
yeah.
And I would supplement it from the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a hard time getting that mulch to actually mulch out that sod.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried Carborn.
You're talking about the thick, clumpy
orchard grass
stuff. Yeah.
So I tried putting it on cardboard, and you know, I'd read, you know, use cardboard,
yep.
And I covered that up with thick hay, and then the hay would dry out, and the wind would blow it off, and then the cardboard would blow away.
Yeah.
So that didn't work too well either. When I was first meandering out into the field cutting grass that wasn't going to seed, it made these really cool pathways out into the field.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife came home from work one day and says, "Hey, you got to come out in the field with me. This is really neat."
Mm-hmm.
So we walked out there, and she starts slipping in her sandals.
Mm-hmm.
And we look, and she's slipping on slug slime.
Oh, wow.
And I look at I was wearing rubber boots because I don't want to get ticks.
Mm-hmm.
And my boots were covered in slugs.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, huh, well, maybe we should get some ducks.
Mm-hmm.
So, started raising ducks. I started using, I made these bottomless houses so I could pile in hay mulch, and then, you know, they'd poop on it, and I had more layers and my layers, and then I moved the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started using that bedding as, instead of cardboard, I put that down where I wanted to create a new garden bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then mow the grass around it, pile that on top.
Mm-hmm.
And by the spring of the next year, the worms had turned that layer of hay, manure, and more hay into this fantastic topsoil. I could just like stir it with my toe.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And
but you said by spring.
So
basically 9 months or something.
Yeah, so
wow.
They'd make the beds over the summer and
fall,
and then by
spring
it'd be ready to go.
Beautiful.
With no digging.
Yeah.
So finally had a gardening system that works.
Uh-huh.
So I could part the mulch, plant the plants,
and
close it up. Or part the mulch and put in the seed.
Mm-hmm.
Still had a weed like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It had been
because it comes up through the hay.
It had been a cornfield.
Yeah,
they had a 3-year crop rotation and
anyway,
a lot of weed seeds.
Yeah,
in clay soil. So.
Mm-hmm.
It started to work. Then a lot of other things evolved. Raccoons would get my ducks, so I got geese to protect the ducks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had chosen Welsh Harlequin ducks, which was a critically endangered breed, and Pilgrim geese, which was an endangered goose breed.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, you know, we really should preserve these small farm, multi-purpose birds.
Mm-hmm.
So I started breeding them, and that put me in the egg business.
Oh, wow.
And which created a lot of fertility for my farm.
Mm-hmm.
The main fertilizer input is actually the duck and goose feed.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
turning into poop and turning into mulch and compost and so on.
Mm-hmm.
My scythe just, I was reading a lot in a book called The Scythe Book.
Mm-hmm.
There's an addendum by Peter Vito.
Mm-hmm.
And what he was talking about, I just could not do with that scythe play side, and I couldn't figure out why.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, Elliot had been killed in a car accident.
Oh, no.
And his wife and his friend Richard took over the business.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't know that much to start with. And then I wrote in the back of the side book, there was a call from Peter Vito to establish a Scythe Retail Network, and he was looking for people interested in forming a retail cooperative.
Cool.
That would not only just sell scythes, but also teach people how to use it.
Yeah.
And I had been learning the hard way for like 5 years.
Right.
And really could see why that would be so useful for people.
Yeah.
Especially if they're just starting out with a scythe.
Yeah.
You know, get something that fit and worked and was sharp and learn how to sharpen it. And
yeah.
So he started calling me every couple of months, and we talked for hours. And he advised me to improve my sharpening skills, so I worked on those.
Self-taught, or he showed you some things, gave you some tips.
Yeah. And he was also going to send me a scythe, but he never did quite get to it. He says, I think about you every day, because when I walk out the door, I walk by the scythe handle, the snab that I made for you, but I just haven't paired it with a blade yet. And at the so in 2006, he decided to bring in some instructors from Europe and have an international scythe symposium at his farm.
Oh, cool.
And so I went to that, and so I learned scything from like 7 different instructors. And each one had a different way of doing things. And it was a bit overwhelming at first. And but I kind of absorbed things like a sponge, and I synthesize it later. And I brought home 5 different scythes and a bunch of extra blades. And also while I was there, there was, of all the instructors, they're all very, very busy, except one guy. His name was Ernst Schossweil. He was the engineer from the factory in Austria.
Making the scythes?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And he didn't speak any English.
Oh.
And I knew enough German from when I was a kid to be able to understand what he was saying. So he was teaching me how to, not only how to scythe and somewhat how to peen. He was just a master of peening, but he did it on a wide anvil, which is like the hardest way to do it. But if you really want to master it, that's the way to do it.
And peening, I'm sure plenty of our listeners don't know. We might get into some of this technical stuff in a little bit if we have time. But peening is what? It's when you're hammering the scythe blade.
Yeah, you hammer the edge thin, and then you dress it with a whetstone.
Right.
Anyway, I was telling him how difficult it was to get really good scythe equipment in this country. And I had heard that Dick Tools of Germany sells a really good one, but you can't get it here. He says, "Well, if you want, I can set you up with a wholesale account like the same as Dick Tools, and you can sell them."
Cool.
So I said, "Okay."
And what manufacturer is this person working for?
Schreck and Fuchs. Yeah. It's a scythe factory that's been around for over 500 years.
Wow.
They've modernized their equipment, but
and that was the first thing you started importing.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I had to check in with my wife first at the.
Of course.
So anyway, came home, told me, had all these great scythes, and I said, and they were handmade snabs. Peter Vito had made these out of birch saplings.
And I should clarify for the listener. A lot of people probably don't know what a snath is. So now we're starting to talk about some of the components of a scythe. What's a snath?
That's the handle.
The handle
that attaches. that you attach the blade to.
You attach to the blade, right.
Yeah, it's got two grips,
mm-hmm.
or the type I sell has two grips.
Mm-hmm.
So I told my wife about it. She said, oh, that's great. Mm-hmm. Acres USA is coming to Minnesota
mm-hmm.
in December,
mm-hmm.
and we can import the size and debut them at the trade show.
Oh, cool. Brilliant.
So
sell them all in one go.
Yeah, so we imported a small shipment, and I taught my first scythe workshop in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And then we took them to Acres USA, and I was all excited. We're like the first ones to have these here.
Mm-hmm.
They're like state-of-the-art handles and blades that had extra sharpening done mm-hmm. to them. So, you know, when you get them, they're like really sharp, ready mm-hmm. to go.
Mm-hmm.
Really good peening equipment, really good whetstones. Anyway, so there was this great equipment, taking it to Acres USA. We had like the second booth in from the entranceway.
Mm-hmm.
And so in between classes, these waves of farmers would come into the
mm-hmm.
the trade show hall.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd start walking towards me, and they'd have a puzzled look on their face, and they mm-hmm. go, what are you selling?
Mm-hmm.
And then they just recoil in horror, and they go, size? I hate those things. And they just wave me off and,
uh-huh.
and walk away.
Uh-huh. And how many did you sell?
I think we sold like a dozen.
Oh, that's not too bad.
It was, you know, small organic growers. We yeah. met some great people.
Yeah.
But I'll never forget the disgust and disdain from the farmers.
Yeah.
Who, you know, like, oh, my grandfather used to make me use one, or my dad used to make me use one.
Probably all these.
Hate those things. They're so much work.
Yeah. Yeah, that, I mean, that's, it's really, that's really interesting to hear and expected. And it connects to another question I have for you, which is I think on your website you mentioned that when you decided to farm by hand, principally using a scythe, your friends thought you were crazy.
Yeah, too much work.
Yeah, too much work. These farmers thought you were crazy. And you talked a little bit about your motivation for deciding to undertake this task, this method, this way of farming these tools. You said you can't stand machines.
Yeah,
you like
I gotta
the peace
admit.
And quiet. I mean, you know, it sounds like you like being outside and listening to the non-mechanical sounds that are outside.
Yeah, you can hear the birds when you're scything.
You can hear the birds. I'm curious if there are any other motivations that you maybe knew about beforehand, but also maybe learned about as you were working with the scythe, and you know, and not just like rationalizations justifying your original motivation, you know, like need reasons to keep going or anything, but like other like reasons. Other things that you noticed about how you were farming, what you were growing, how the quality of what you're growing, or anything like that, that kind of like got under your skin and committed you to both farming in this way and educating people about farming this way and giving them the tools and the knowledge of how to use the tools to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to admit that not liking machinery was a
big one.
It was a big one.
Yeah, I mean, okay, full disclosure, I can't stand machines, I can't fix them, and that is an enormous reason why I bought a scythe from you and why
I'm not alone.
It's what I use, yeah.
It's what
I'm
learning.
That revulsion is, yeah, it can't be underestimated or discounted. And yeah. I guess like these farmers who are coming into your booth at Acres, who are revolted by your scythes, maybe don't have that just like instinctive revulsion of machinery. They might be savvy mechanics and be mechanically curious and like to work on machines. I don't know. I'm not one of these yeah. guys. I can't.
Well, a large scale, you have to.
You just have to as well yeah. if you're doing a big scale. Yeah.
a bunch of stories here. One is that most people have had experiences with American size.
Yep.
And those used to be very. There used to be very elegant, lightweight versions with mm-hmm. really sharp blades.
Yeah.
Like 125 years ago at the latest. Yeah. But what evolved since then was these beefed up weed whacking versions.
Yeah.
And they were always designed to be sharpened on grindstones. And when yeah. people didn't have, you know, grindstone and yeah. a water cooled grindstone,
right.
they stopped being sharpened.
Right.
So they just like were crudely sharpened with files
yeah.
and stones. And
is that right that they weren't, did you say that they weren't really designed for like a farm operation? They're more kind of just like yard maintenance and gardening.
No, they were designed to whack down weeds that you couldn't get to.
Okay.
Where you couldn't get to with a tractor, basically.
Okay, got it. So kind of clearing nooks and crannies of brush yeah. and weeds and stuff.
Yeah. So okay. yeah. So the dad or grandpa would send the kid out to whack some weeds somewhere, you know,
in some corner of the.
Yeah, and that's why the kids
hated it.
Learned to hate them.
They were probably sitting in bramble and milkweed and getting cut up and having to probably taking rose bushes to the face and stuff.
Yeah,
they're miserable.
They're sent some.
Yeah.
To whack down some weeds somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, and with the what I was learning about soil and what I had gotten originally interested in was both with the One Straw Revolution with
yeah.
Fukuoka and
yeah.
also Ruth Stout.
Mm-hmm.
And I also used to go to these sustainable land use meetings where they talked about their no-till.
Mm-hmm.
Tilling is very bad for the soil and
mm-hmm.
the environment,
mm-hmm.
and figuring out no-till solutions is
critical.
It's something I've been very interested in for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the motivation of using a scythe. My plan was not to, or to dig as little as possible,
right.
and to create mulch
mm-hmm.
without having to get machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Or by hay that's full of weed seeds.
Right.
So I just wanted to be able to really control
mm-hmm.
and build the soil.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you can't really do it that way without a scythe.
Yeah, and that was my my motivation going into the year 2000, but. By 2006, I was already just really alarmed about climate change.
Right.
And even on the flight to International Scythe Symposium,
mm-hmm.
I was sitting next to somebody from Alaska. And
yeah.
I asked them, have you noticed any signs of climate change?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's just, permafrost is melting. And,
yeah.
And then at the Scythe Symposium, I asked people from Austria,
mm-hmm.
are you seeing signs of climate change? And they say, yeah, we call it climate catastrophe.
Right.
Because glaciers that have been around, as long as they have recorded history, they're
yeah.
slowly melting, and then
yeah.
the whole mountainsides are collapsing.
Right.
Huge landslides. Houses that have stood for 500 years
yeah.
are collapsing under the weight of snow all of a sudden because there's so much snow.
Wow.
And anyway, that was back in 2006. I can't even imagine what it's like now.
Yeah.
So being aware of the climate change being caused by fossil fuels, I started thinking that we needed to voluntarily reduce how much fuel we were burning.
Mm-hmm.
And that fit really well into my
right.
loathing of machinery anyway.
Right. Yeah. I, another motivation for finding a way to make this tool work for you. I wanted to read something that I lifted from your website that I'm sure you wrote. I'm not sure when. I'm just going to read it, and then I'll maybe make just a comment on it and let you wax philosophical. Okay. And I did want to mention to our listeners that you are listening to WDRT. My name is Tony, and my guest today in our special interview is Botan Anderson, and we're talking about farming by hand. Here's the quote from Botan's website. Whether you are alarmed about climate catastrophe, peak oil, social justice, healthcare, food safety and security, or all of the above, at their roots, they all have one solution in common. We must fundamentally change the way we grow our food. Big mechanized chemical agriculture is ruining our health, depleting our soil, building up toxins in our environment, eroding and leaching the soil, massively increasing CO2 levels in our atmosphere, and financially devastating the closest thing that we have to sustainable farmers, namely small family farms. Peak oil expert Richard Heinberg speculates that in order to continue to grow the same amount of food in the future without burning fossil fuels, we will need 40 to 50 million farmers farming 3 to 50 acres, mostly with hand tools. No, not like in the Middle Ages. We are talking about appropriate technology here and fundamentally rethinking our growing methods to work with nature. That's a quote from Botan, your website. OneSideRevolution.com. I love a lot of things about this quote, but one thing I love is that it's so future thinking. Farming by hand isn't about returning to some fantasy that we might have of the idyllic past and us being more part of nature or something. Although there may be parts of that in all of this for some people. But really, it's about finding a way forward. And I was wondering, Botan, if you could say a little bit more about this way forward that human beings and their hand tools have to offer. So, like, can you fill out this vision of millions of farmers working, presumably many of them working together with their hands, with their hand tools, small parcels of land compared to the enormous tracts we have now, 3 to 50 acres. I'm just wondering if you could fill that out and make it compelling to some of our listeners, because we don't have a ton of models, especially here in the upper Mississippi and the plains and the Midwest in general. We have huge hundreds of acres farms, mechanized, growing very little food, actually.
Yeah, actually, it's like we're not even growing food, we're growing ethanol and soybean ink and, you know, who knows.
Cattle else. Feed, I guess.
Pig feed. And,
yeah.
It's not something food. That... It's not very efficient.
Yeah.
And it's all burning fossil fuels. And right. I've just been learning that most of the fertilizer is nitrogen.
Right.
Fertilizer.
Right.
Which... leaches away very quickly and ends up in our groundwater, so now we have to have our wells tested for nitrates.
And people are losing their wells. One of my neighbor can't drink from her well anymore.
Yeah, so that's what I was saying. I wrote that on my website in 2008.
Yeah, I figured it was from around then, yeah.
Yeah, since then I've been... very pleased with the methods, the success of the methods.
Yeah.
My methods.
Yeah.
But dismayed by the progress we, as a civilization, we're making.
I feel the same way.
I feel like we're, at this point, just doomed.
Yeah. It's not looking great.
No. So what... What I would see is working is like possibly growing biofuels around combines for growing small grains that feed us and birds, which are the species of mammals designed to eat grains. And instead of growing massive amounts of corn and soybeans for pig feed,
mm-hmm.
And for cattle,
mm-hmm.
which and all that corn just makes them sick, from what I hear.
Mm-hmm.
Return to a grazing model for mm-hmm. for livestock,
right?
Which helps regenerate, which keeps the soil covered,
mm-hmm.
and actually sequesters carbon if we
mm-hmm.
keep it green and growing.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of feedlot cattle, you know, I see pastured cattle,
mm-hmm.
And the larger, you know, larger fields and so on, you know, could be grazing animals.
Mm-hmm.
And small greens, but everything's got to get smaller.
Everything's got to get smaller, yeah.
And the vegetables, the poultry, all that stuff can be grown on much, much smaller scale, local,
yep.
with intensive methods with hand tools.
Right.
And, you know, recycling the nutrients, you know, with composting.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of using petroleum-based nitrates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is this to say that one update to your vision is the grazing component?
Huge.
The importance of that.
It's
you can't do it without it.
Yeah, it's hugely important.
Yeah.
Also, you know, we got to green up the planet rapidly, so
yeah.
planting a lot more trees.
Yeah.
Cover crops. I was just on the drive over here, I was noticing these huge, huge plowed fields
yeah.
with no cover crop.
That, it's incredible.
That should have been covered with rye.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And would have been, even if the government subsidizes farmers, you know, pays them to
yeah.
cover it with rye, it would
yeah.
just, it would hold the soil in place. It would add so much organic matter to the soil, which
right.
is sequestering carbon.
Right. So, I mean, connected to one, I guess, connected a little bit to some of the bleakness that I think we both feel. Like, what do you think can be said to inspire people to take up some of these things, to take up a scythe, take up a hand tool, to put away their ride a mower, put away their brush hog. It certainly seems to me, and I don't get out much or get around much, but there's definitely a regenerative agriculture movement underfoot in this region and across the world, I assume,
mm-hmm.
that is very interested in grazing and forests. Incorporating trees into the agricultural models. And it does, as you were telling me before we started this on-air conversation, it sounds like there's every year you have something like 500 new customers buying scythes. So there's some interest. And I guess I'm just curious what you think can kind of like make this a realistic option for people in their own imagination about how they live their lives and how they work on their farm. Because I think a lot of people think it's kind of an eccentric hobby and like maybe you just have to really dislike being around machines in order to do it. But a lot of people don't dislike being around machines, so they hop on their mower and, you know, just get it done and go back to whatever else they were doing. What are some words of like encouragement, wisdom, fleshing out of imaginative detail that we can give listeners to really inspire them to like think of small scale farming using less mechanization and some of these hand tools? Mm-hmm. What are some things that we can say to bring some people into the group hug of hand farming?
Yeah. Well, so when I started thinking about Richard Heinberg's vision for, you know, we need, you know, 50 million more farmers farming much smaller acreages with mostly with hand tools.
Yeah.
I was imagining how agriculture has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, moved further away from cities. There's been suburban sprawl, you know, moving out into the country, turning these really nice farm fields into suburbs. And I was imagining that reversing and having agriculture come back into the suburbs. And that's where the hand tool scale would come back. And the, you know, the small landowner needs to think about what they're doing on their land. You know, do you need half an acre of grass lawn that you have to water and fertilize?
Right.
Or can you grow food there?
Right.
Do you need to chop down all these, all this brush and trees and haul it away? Or can it be fed the goats? Or can you turn it into biochar?
Right.
You
know, right.
So it's like, it's like we have this mentality of, you know, you mow everything and cut everything and rake all the leaves and, and you send it all away.
Or burn it or something.
Yeah, that. But if you actually recycle all those nutrients and use it to grow food, it would change the nutrient cycle and the use of fuels, fuel use cycles, I guess. And turn it into something that's sustainable instead of, you know, wasteful and polluting. And
really on a scale like that, it wouldn't even require that much work. And presumably if you're doing this in like a suburban setting, which is presumably more populated, you'd have hopefully have more help close by to do it.
Yes. If people mowed their lawns with a scythe, a scythe stroke ends up depositing the grass all in the windrow on the side, which you can then just gather up and use as mulch. Right there, somewhere, somewhere close by.
Right, and you, I should mention
so
too.
So you're harvesting your lawn for the nutrients to grow food.
And I should mention to our listeners that you've got beautiful YouTube videos on your website of you doing this, and it's just incredible to watch because you so quickly and efficiently and kind of beautifully take down these swaths of grass in these rows, and then you can see the grass just like that you're taking down just like laying in this perfect row, and it's just it's basically new earth that you're creating and just minutes really, and it's quite easy, and it's such a resource what's growing even on your lawn.
Yeah, so you can let your lawn grow longer,
a little bit longer.
The legal limits are what, 6-8 inches in the town?
Oh, I think around here it's half an inch.
You can
once it's half an inch, you have to mow it. It's unbelievable. I don't know where the practice comes from, but it rained a lot last year, and it was noisy at our farm. We don't live super close to our neighbors, but people are mowing.
Yeah,
every other day, I think.
One thing when you're out scything, and you could just be listening to the birds, you can really hear all the lawnmowers in the area.
Yeah.
That sound carries a long ways.
It really does. It ricochets off the hills and the.
Just think, if everybody was using a scythe, you know, we could all hear the birds.
Yep.
But
the sound of the scythe itself is so beautiful to me. It's so soothing to listen to that all growing season as I'm mowing.
Yeah, when I was first making YouTube videos, my wife, when she had a really stressful social work job.
Yeah.
She'd come home and. Before bed, she'd watch my videos, because it was so soothing. So
oh man,
help her.
Too bad she couldn't have the actual experience, but
yeah, I don't think she was ever that into it. But okay.
But she loved the sound and the soothing. I don't know if anyone's
like listening to surf. She said
it is. It has that sound. Mm-hmm. I don't.
So you have surf and the birds.
Yeah,
and
yeah. It, incidentally, that sound is really, I find, really captured by that Terrence Malick movie, which you must have seen. Have you seen this? I can't remember the name. Beautiful shots of people scything around the time of World War II.
Oh yeah, in the
Alps.
I think in the
Austrian Alps. Yeah. Yeah. So it's there's a I think one thing to take out of what you just said is in terms of like inspiring or piquing people's interest is that this is possible. It is actually possible. You can get a scythe and you can mow a part of a piece of land.
Yeah.
And
harvest it
and you can get productivity out of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you needn't decide to, if you have, I don't know, 10, 20 acres or something that you're living on or working, you needn't necessarily commit to like mowing 20 acres with your scythe. You could do a portion and play with it and use it. You could focus on using it in your garden. And I wanted to ask you this question in connection with a number of things that has come up, but you could also just not mow everything, which is something that I have two little kids and I farm with scythe and other hand tools and no mechanization aside from a ride a mower pulling a wagon of a heavy load sometimes. Mm-hmm. And well, my family and I have had to kind of like learn to live with what I think in our society is considered kind of a mess. You know, and yeah, we have tick problems sometimes. I try to stay on top of it for everyone so we don't get tick bites, but you just don't have to mow everything. You may want to protect forest from invasives, honeysuckle and such that are going to crowd out trees and make it impossible to make the land productive or to have the forest expand and grow, but you can leave land alone, and it's not going to be the end of the world. You can choose parts of land to cultivate and manicure, even if that's your style. You know, if you really need like this tidy, I don't know, European garden thing that looks very idyllic, you can do that in sections and also let other spots run wild, so long as like you're not going to lose things that are vital to the environment and the ecosystem.
When I originally bought my 20 acres, my idea was to have 10 acres just be wild.
Yeah.
And then actually only farmed 8 acres, mm-hmm. which included the house and the land around it.
Yeah.
And the 2-acre strip at the bottom of the first 10 acres was white pine woods in a with a stream, mm-hmm. let that be wild. Mm-hmm. And the north part, which was dairy cow pasture, mm-hmm. with a lot of hawthorns and apple trees, and mm-hmm. and I just let that be wild too. So mm-hmm. the deer had that, and mm-hmm. and I was farming on my 8 acres, mm-hmm. of which very little of it was ever tilled. More of the intensive kitchen garden area closer to the house, you know, that
a little bit, yeah,
that'd be Broad Fork more than I never had to Broad Fork where I mulch with the duck and goose bedding. Mm-hmm. In England there's a movement called rewilding, mm-hmm. where areas that are let or they either they help it return to the wild or they just let it return to the wild. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they have older breeds of cattle, mm-hmm. that they let graze in mm-hmm. the more wild areas. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Iowa policy of fence row to fence row, you know, plow everything, is bad for wildlife too.
Yeah.
Also native plants, you can return some of your land to native prairie.
Yeah.
Oak savannas.
Yep.
You know, all the brush that needs to be removed for healing our woods and savannas, you know, the buckthorn and so on. That all can be cut and turned into biochar.
Yeah.
You cut it, let it dry, and then you can pile it in big brush piles and light them from the top.
Yeah.
And then the air can, as the flame works its way, it'll just burn like a nuclear meltdown.
Yeah.
Core reactor meltdown.
Yeah.
It just burns from the top down through the center, the core.
Yeah.
Because the air comes in evenly through all the
brush
piled up. And anyway, it just burns much hotter and cleaner than how we usually burn things. And then you just have to put it out when it's at the red hot coal stage.
Yeah.
So you have to have a, ideally pile these, make these brush piles close to where you can get to with a hose.
Yeah.
But if you put it out at the charcoal stage, then you've stopped the burning and the coals are the carbon.
Yep.
Most of the high flames
when
you start a fire, that's the methanes and gases burning off.
Yeah.
And that turns into CO2 and water vapor, I think.
Yeah.
But it's better than methane.
Yeah.
And then, but the bulk of the physical carbon, you can stop from burning by putting out the coals.
Yeah.
And then you can add that to compost or garden soil.
Yeah.
Or use as manure, deodorizer.
Yeah.
Mix it with manure and it'll soak up the nitrogens.
Yeah.
And hold it and make it a slow release fertilizer when you compost it or use it in a garden or field.
Yeah.
But anyway, all that brush can be turned into something useful.
Yep.
Sequestered.
Yeah.
It'll greatly increase the fertility to the soil.
Yeah.
If you mix it with compost.
Yeah.
It's biochar by itself adds fertility. Compost by itself adds fertility.
Yeah.
But compost and biochar is
maximum.
More than
increases
fertility more than either
individually. Right.
So it's like synergistic.
Yeah. That's incredible.
And all that can be done with hand tools too.
Yeah, exactly.
Or I've become a fan of the electric chainsaw for bigger stuff.
Oh, good.
My arms just couldn't take hand sawing.
Yeah, my arms are getting a little tired too with with hand saws. Still using them. So inspiring, this conversation for me, and I hope it's been inspiring for you too, Botan, and our listeners. And I guess just one reflection on your work is how engaged these tools help us be with our environment and the other animals other than humans living in the environment and even with other humans, the people we're living and working with. And I guess maybe for me that is another potential to be tapped around these tools and this method of farming. So thank you very much, Botan.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's a pleasure having somebody so interested in what I do.
Thank you for listening. Tuning in, checking out some of the things that Botan and I are thinking about. You can reach Botan at onesiderevolution.com. You can find me around Viroqua or at my farm. I'm sure you'll figure that one out. And I appreciate it.